This is edition number 2008 of The Mardler, recorded at Aylsham on Friday the 13th of March 2026. Hello, and a warm welcome to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper. Just one item from the notice board this week. The sun rises at around 6:15 in the morning and sets at around 6 o'clock in the evening. Our week's news and views are from the North Norfolk News of Thursday the 12th of March. I am Judith Elliott-Hunter and my fellow readers are
Mary Wilson,
John Hoyle
and Robert Watton.
The magazine supplement, which includes thoughts about spiders, school days memories, Are Sundays Boring? And Norfolk's unique home guard follows later. But first, memorabilia from a 125-year-old family garage go under the hammer, plans to halve bus shelter face formal complaint, Broad's households will be forced to use 20% less water. However, we lead with rival towns join force in bid to win £3 million prize in UK-wide competition. Cromer and Sheringham have been known for their friendly but intense rivalry against each other for centuries. But now they have come together in a joint bid in the first ever UK Town of Culture competition, with the aim to celebrate and strengthen the creative heritage of the two towns. The government has invited towns to enter the new competition, which will run alongside the existing UK City of Culture contest. The winner will get £3 million to deliver a cultural programme in 2028 of around 6 months, with two runners-up receiving £250,000 to support cultural activity. Community leaders and art organisations across the towns have joined forces to develop an expression of interest in the coming weeks to showcase the North Norfolk coast as a vibrant, creative and cultural centre. It also hopes to highlight the importance of the creative industries within the local economy, recognising the significant contribution it makes to tourism and employment. It has been brought forward through collaboration between Sheringham Little Theatre, local cultural organisations, and Liz Withington, North Norfolk District Councillor for Sheringham. Debbie Thompson, Director of Sheringham Little Theatre, said, "Sheringham and Cromer already have a remarkable cultural offer built on decades of creativity, community participation, and partnership. A Town of Culture application would allow us to bring those assets together in a more coordinated way, strengthening the cultural infrastructure that supports venues, artists and community organisations across the area. Most importantly, it would help ensure the arts and culture remain accessible to everyone in our communities." Ms Withington added, "Together we can champion North Norfolk as a place where creativity, culture and heritage are valued, and where artists and creative communities can continue to grow, inspire and contribute to the prosperity of the region. Anyone wishing to be involved with the bid should contact Beth Graham at marketing@sheringhamlittletheatre.com.
Vintage signage and memorabilia from a family-run business that closed after more than a century of trading is set to go under the hammer. East Coast Motor Company in Cromer closed in December after 105 years in the town, after rising costs became impossible to overcome. And now a huge range of garage machinery and equipment from the company will be auctioned off across the span of 4 days. The auction, organised by Arnold Keyes, will be held online and will consist of 179 lots of tools, garage machinery, office equipment and vintage signage. Some of the lots include old Ford signs, Formula One showroom posters, vintage policeman torches, and a collection of different tools. This is an opportunity for people in the motor trade and amateur mechanics alike to buy a huge range of garage machinery and equipment," said Simon Evans, partner at Arnold Keyes. We expect that those interested in Cromer's history may want to bid for some of the historical items, such as a framed Austin 7 garage chart. The East Coast Motor Company was part of the town for more than a century, and this is a chance to own a little part of that history. The garage first opened in Church Street in 1919, before moving to its current site on Beach Road. The firm, which was run by four generations of the same family, started out selling a range of car brands, including Austin, Morris, BMC, MG and Rover. The company was formerly known as Cromer Motors and opened its Ford dealership on Beach Road in 1967. The auction will take place from 9 a.m. on Friday, March the 20th, to 5 p.m. on Monday, March 23rd. Two viewing days for prospective buyers will take place at the Beach Road site on March 19th and 20th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. The four-day timed auction takes place online on the Arnold Keys website, where the full catalogue can also now be viewed.
A town council has now been slapped with a formal complaint after it agreed to plans to cut a 1950s bus shelter in half. Sheringham Town Council is facing questions over its decision-making process after agreeing to a proposal which retains only half of the beloved bus shelter off-station approach. It was due to be torn down by Norfolk County Council in December in its plans for a travel hub, but this was halted following a sit-in protest and the town council voting to save the structure. But at a meeting 2 weeks ago, the council agreed to revise Norfolk County Council transport hub scheme, which removes the front half of the shelter, leaving some people in the town feeling betrayed. Now, the new campaign group, the Sheringham Travel and Safety Partnership, has lodged a complaint against the Town Council concerning its decision on the project. It raises concerns about governance, procedural compliance, and decision-making processes. This has included whether the Town Council's decision complied with a 6-month rule on reconsidering motions, and whether it carried out the proper process to rescind a previous decision. It also raises questions as to whether adequate due diligence was undertaken in reviewing consultation evidence and whether any procurement steps have been initiated without explicit council authority. The group has requested that no irreversible works to alter the shelter proceed while these governance matters are reviewed. A spokesman for the partnership said, "This complaint is about lawful process, transparency and public confidence. It's not about obstructing progress. If we're to deliver a safe, integrated and widely supported transport hub for Sheringham, the decisions that underpin it must be robust and beyond procedural doubt." The partnership has asked for a full written response under the Town Council's complaints procedure and confirmation as to whether independent legal advice will be sought. The group has called to reset and strengthen the plans for the site with a constructive partnership before work begins this autumn and for an open steering group to be set up. Sheringham Town Council has been contacted for comment about the complaint submission.
Those dreaming of an idyllic life on the Norfolk Broads may need to carefully plan their visits to the toilet amid plans to restrict the amount of water people can use in a day. Households will have to use 20% less water in the future under tough new planning policies for housing developments, equivalent to about 5 loo flushes a day. Officials want to restrict water usage for new builds to 90 litres per day per person, 20 litres less than is currently allowed. The Broads Authority, in brackets BA, has proposed the measures following lobbying from water companies in the region who want more done to protect one of the driest regions in England from future water shortages. Latest predictions for the east of England show there could be a 730 million litre deficit of water supply by 2050. However, the new scheme will mean developers will have to pay about £2,000 more to install more water-efficient plumbing systems to avoid breaking the rules. The new policy forms part of the BA's local plan, a key document that defines how new developments should take place in the Broads, which is currently being reviewed. Minimum water efficiency standards were introduced by the government in 2010 and require that all new homes use no more than 125 litres per person a day. But planning authorities, such as the BA, are urged to impose tougher restrictions to areas affected by water stress. Ahead of the new local plan being submitted to local government officials for approval, Anglian Water, Essex and Suffolk Water and the Environment Agency called on the BA to cut water usage. Anglian Water told the BA it is clear that tighter water efficiency standards are necessary for sustainable growth and nature recovery, which supports the purpose of conserving and enhancing the natural beauty, wildlife and cultural heritage of the Broads. Developers will have to prove that new developments will meet the new 90-litre threshold by using more efficient taps, showers, toilets and other appliances. Rainwater harvesting and grey water recycling using wastewater from residential sources like showers, baths, sinks and washing machines could also be used to cut water usage. If the developer cannot prove the new home will meet the restrictions, it will be unlikely to gain planning permission. Existing homeowners in the Broads do not need to worry about making any changes, as they will not be expected to retrofit their new homes to meet the new standards. The changes will also have implications for tourism businesses, such as campsites in the Broads, which will have to impose more water-efficient measures for new toilets, showers and washing-up areas. The Broads is the biggest wetland area in the country and home to a vast network of rivers and lakes. But it is also considered to be an area at high risk of future water shortages. Levels of abstraction, where water is removed to help with tasks such as irrigating farms, continue to put pressure on its river systems. There are already strict controls on the amount of water that can be removed in parts of the Broads. Removing too much water risks damaging the environment and health of the ecosystems that thrive in the wetlands. Anglian Water offers a £500 financial sweetener for developers that achieve a water usage of 90 litres per day per person. Essex and Suffolk Water have a similar scheme.
Controversial plans to house 200 refugees in buildings which were once part of RAF Coltishall have been scrapped. Home Office contractors informed Broadland District Council yesterday morning that it was withdrawing plans to temporarily house Afghan refugees in the former officers' mess at the base, near Bardersfield. Contractor BM Trust had been seeking temporary permission for 12 months to use the Jaguar buildings at the base to house the migrants. The refugees are Afghans and their families, who worked with the British following the invasion of their country in 2001. They have been given permission to relocate and resettle in the UK, and the Home Office wanted to use the Norfolk site to allow time to find them settled accommodation elsewhere. Home Office contractors, BM Trust, emailed officers at Broadland to announce the withdrawal of the proposals, but did not give a reason for the decision. However, the applicant had been putting pressure on the council for a quick decision over the plans and previously said it was imperative a decision was made no later than February. The application was not on the agenda for Broadland's February Planning Committee and was also absent from the agenda for last week's meeting. The proposal had met with resistance from some of the residents in Bardersfield, who claimed the area was unsuitable because of a lack of facilities. Some had put up posters around the village protesting against the plans. Buxton with Lammas Parish Council, Horsted with Stanninghall Parish Council and Coldishall Parish Council have also objected, saying the site is not suitable. Officials at the NHS Norfolk and Waveney Integrated Care Board had also raised concerns about the impact of needing to register 200 people with GPs at a time when many were already at capacity. Government ministers found themselves under mounting pressure to find suitable accommodation for migrants following widespread protests last year. Unlike those currently housed in hotels, which have been the focus for the demonstrations, the migrants who would have moved to Bardersfield were refugees, not asylum seekers.
Hopes for a new dentistry school in Norwich to tackle Norfolk's dental desert, which stops people getting NHS treatment, have been handed a huge boost. The government has announced it will fund an extra 50 undergraduate dentistry places, and there is optimism that will mean the University of East Anglia's dental school can finally be launched. The UEA already has accreditation from the General Dental Council to provide undergraduate dental training, and a £3 million dentistry centre is being created in a new extension of the Edith Cavell building at the Norfolk and Norwich University Hospital. But the UEA needed the government to agree funding for dental places, which it has now done, instructing the Office for Students to prioritise places in areas where dentists are not being trained. MPs of all political hues had been pressing the government to act, with a shortage of dentists meaning that many people in Norfolk cannot get NHS dental treatment. The hope is that once the school is established and dentists trained up, some will stay to work in Norfolk. The UEA intends to submit a bid for new dentistry training places when the Office for Students opens the process and would be ready to welcome its first students in September 2027. Professor David Maguire, Vice Chancellor of UEA, said, "UEA's civic mission is central to our ambition for new dentistry provision. Training dentists locally is proven to help recruit and retain them in the region, and this region needs them urgently. We are grateful for the strong cross-party support of our local MPs, whose sustained advocacy has helped bring this issue to the forefront in Westminster. Our plans are ready and our NHS partnerships are established. If places can be allocated swiftly on a needs-based allocation, we can open applications for students to begin training with us in September 2027. Jerome Mayhew, Conservative MP for Broadland and Fakenham, said, "Rural areas struggle to attract newly qualified dentists to start their careers away from cities, so training homegrown talent is even more important. We know from the experience of the medical school at the UEA that about 40% of newly qualified medical professionals end up working close to where they trained. Yet the nearest training school for dentists is Birmingham or London."
Listed buildings in a Norfolk market town, including a former bank, are to be turned into new homes. Broadland District Council has granted permission for offices in Reefham's marketplace to be turned into 6 homes. Members of the Council's Planning Committee approved the Original Holding Company Limited's application for the conversion of existing offices in the town's Bank House, Carlton House and Melton House. Bank House used to be a Barclays bank, but that closed decades ago, and the building is currently empty, having previously been home to the original cottage company. Permission was granted to convert the first and second floor offices into 3 apartments, comprising 2 one-bedroom units at the first floor and a 2-bedroom unit at the second floor. the ground floor of Bank House would remain available for commercial use, including as offices. Carlton House and Melton House will be converted into one two-bedroom dwelling, a two-bedroom first-floor apartment, and a one-bedroom apartment at the back. Reefham Town Council had said it was worried about the impact on parking if the offices became homes. But officers at Broadland District Council said they did not have any concerns about that issue, given the buildings are close to free public car parks. All the buildings are Grade 2 listed by Historic England and are within Reefham's conservation area. Melton House and Carlton House date to the 18th century but were refronted in the 19th century, while Bank House was built in the early 19th century.
Those living in Norfolk will catch a glimpse of a historic Spitfire next month. A commemorative flight will be making its way around the UK to mark 90 years since the aircraft's first journey. There will be a series of 9 Spitfire flights starting in Southampton on Tuesday, April the 7th. The first flight will be the longest, with the plane in the air for an estimated hour and a half. Historic aircraft from the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight, in brackets BBMF, will accompany the Spitfire on this flight, with modern RAF aircraft joining for the subsequent journeys. The route of the first flight will take it east along the south coast, flying over London and into Suffolk, across Norfolk, before landing at RAF Coningsby in Lincolnshire. The 9 flights are running as part of a charity auction, with the highest bidder granted a seat on the plane for one of the stints. Winners will experience a flight on board a BS140, a 2-seater model painted exclusively for this event in the colours of K5054, the Spitfire prototype. Currently, bidding for the flight that will head over Norfolk and Suffolk sits at £5,700, but the auction remains open until March the 22nd, so it will likely continue increasing until then. On March the 5th, 1936, Captain Joseph Mutt Summers piloted the prototype K5054 from Eastleigh Aerodrome. Just 8 minutes into the flight, he is quoted as saying, "Don't change a thing." Speaking about the commemorative flights, a BBMF spokesman said, "The Spitfire became a symbol of British resilience during the Second World War, playing a pivotal role in the Battle of Britain and securing its place as one of the most iconic aircraft in aviation history." The BBMF, which operates 5 Spitfires of its own, will join K5054 in the air during the first commemorative flight before escorting it to its first landing location at RAF Coningsby, the home of the BBMF.
A town and its surrounding villages will soon benefit from more bus services. Matthew Taylor, District Councillor for Stalham, Sutton and Catfield, has announced that from April, Stalham will have an expanded Connect bus service on the 5B route. Mr Taylor said the new buses include a direct service every hour from Stalham to Norwich, so there will be no more changing in Hofton. There will also be multiple late services coming back from the city. "This is absolutely huge news for our communities," he said. "The new timetable will come into action in April. I'll share as soon as I have access to it." The proposal for the extended service was put forward last year after Mr Taylor met Connect Bus Network Manager Steve Royal to discuss improvements to the 5B route. Currently, the 5B runs between Stalham and the Norfolk and Norwich Hospital via Eton, Norwich City Centre, Dussindale, Rackheath and Wroxham. Since announcing the news, people in the local area have expressed their delight. Joy Gray said, "Lack of regular and later bus services impacts those who don't drive to work. Well done."
A market series will relaunch this spring with a festival feel and a fresh look. Discover North Walsham has revealed plans for a Sunday market series that will drive visitors from across Norfolk and beyond and generate real footfall to the town. North Walsham Town Council is behind the fully funded revival of the historic market, with the first event scheduled to take place on March 29th, April 26th and May 31st in the High Street. The objective is to create a destination event for North Norfolk, explained a spokesman for Discover North Walsham. The High Street will be reimagined as a busy festival-style marketplace. Visitors can expect artisan and independent traders, specialist street food and drinks, live music and performance, creative and lifestyle retail, and a lively, welcoming town centre atmosphere. Visitors will arrive at a town that is clean, welcoming and ready to impress, with clear signposting, printed town maps, a new website and bold vinyl wraps on empty shop units.
A church in a Norfolk village is set for a new car park as it hopes to improve safety and inclusivity for users. Plans have been submitted for a small parking area by All Saints Church in Thornage near Holt to North Norfolk District Council. At the moment, there's only one space at the roadside designated for churchgoers to use, while others parking around 200 metres away along a private track. But as the track is unlit and uneven, members of the church council have said that this has become a deterrent for an ageing congregation and for those with mobility challenges. So, it hopes to relocate parking closer to the Grade 2 listed building, improving safety and inclusivity for users by reducing reliance on a distant, unlit and uneven route. The intention is to keep the area as natural as possible, with no lighting, fencing, signage or permanent structures, while providing spaces for up to 20 vehicles. To view or comment on the plans, search PF 260386 on NNDC's planning portal.
A school's gardening club has won an award for its impressive efforts. Munsley Junior School children have been awarded the RHS School Gardening Awards Level 1 Award after fulfilling several criteria. These included demonstrating an understanding of the benefits of gardening, making growing spaces accessible, using raised pots and clear signs, and developing the school garden. The children have been involved in practical projects such as weeding, planting house plants, and creating signs for the onion beds. These are to be harvested later this year. The club has also planted wildflowers to support bees and other pollinators and grown cress. In addition, the pupils have begun nurturing sweet peas indoors, which will be transferred outside in warmer weather. Pupils have also discussed the positive impact of gardening on well-being and see it as a contributing to maintaining the garden spaces, welcoming appeal. Ellen Hedge and Carol Hale praised the children's hard work, saying the enthusiasm and teamwork displayed by gardening club members has been wonderful to see. The school now aims to build on this achievement and is looking towards working on level 2.
A hit Sunday market has revealed when it will return to a North Norfolk town after a winter break. Back for its sixth year, Holt Sunday Market will host its first event of 2026 on April the 5th after a four-month hiatus. The event runs from April to December on the first Sunday of each month between 10 a.m. and 3 p.m. in the town centre. This year, the market will have 80 regional makers, 12 street food traders, 30 food and drink businesses, a communal dining area and buskers. The event aims to spotlight a curated collection of fledgling and established designers and makers from Norfolk and nearby. Several shops are part of the Holt Sunday Market Rewards Club scheme, offering loyal shoppers discounts and deals over the course of the event. The first event of the year is always one of the busiest, and visitors are advised to arrange parking in advance. Pre-booked parking is available via the Holt Sunday Market website, but when this is full, additional car parking is available at car parks in Albert Street, Church Street, Budgeons and Station Road.
Shoppers and visitors will now see changes when parking at a supermarket in a Norfolk town after a new firm took over charging arrangements. From Monday, the Budgens of Holt car park in Kerridge Way is now managed by the RCP Parking Company. And with this change of hands, there are two differences drivers should be aware of. Now, all spaces in the car park will include 30 minutes of free parking, and after this, charges will then apply. And instead of a pay and display system, a new ticketless system is in force with parking fees due on exit. Many have criticised the short period of free parking, with some describing it as ridiculous, and others have said that 30 minutes is a joke. But in a post online, C.T. Baker, Budgens of Elsham and Holt, said, "This change is about keeping spaces available for customers while making it easier for everyone to enjoy both Budgens and our wonderful town. We know Holt thrives because people can shop local with ease, and this update is designed to support exactly that, keeping parking fair, simple and stress-free for our community."
A barn in a state of decay in a Norfolk Broads village is set to be demolished and rebuilt larger than before. Wroxham Home Farms, a sixth-generation family farming business, has submitted a proposal to Broadland Council to tear down a barn at Broadhouse Barn in Wroxham. The barn, which is currently occupied by Nick Hindle, stonemasons, has been described as in a state of decay, with growth and degradation evident, with damage to its roof and wall materials. And in its place, the farming firm wants to build a larger two-storey barn, which will provide two more business units and help with the viability of the overall development. A planning statement said, "The intention is to create a barn which is economically viable as a new build, but which retains sympathetic characteristics towards its rural context. The proposal also includes a new parking area with 30 new car parking spaces and 6 cycle spaces which can be shared between the new barn and another existing commercial barn on the site. To view or comment on the plans, search 2026 0200 on Broadland Council's planning portal."
A Norfolk manor house and estate has been given the go-ahead to reinstate a feature which was previously demolished. The Mannington Hall estate is set for a new visitor centre after North Norfolk District Council approved the plans. In the proposal submitted by owner Richard Ellis, the new centre will be located where the former visitor centre had sat before it was torn down. It is set to include a relocated gift shop and information point kiosk. Mannington was mentioned in the Domesday Book of 1086, and its hall was built around 1460 for William Lumner. It was purchased in the mid-18th century by diplomat Horatio Walpole, the first Lord Walpole, and became known for its Gothic windows, motif chimneys and distinct snapped flint facade. The Walpole family, including the late Lord Walpole, who died in 2021, remained the owners until last year, when it passed to the Ellis family. The cafe has been refurbished and is now operated by Norfolk Bakery Bread Source, and work is also being carried out on the holiday cottages.
The reopening of a pier restaurant in North Norfolk has been pushed back. Tides Bistro on Cromer Pier is currently undergoing renovation works. The eatery closed earlier this year, and officials had told locals that the restaurant would be reopening in time for Easter. However, a spokesman for the pier has now confirmed that this will not be the case. The aim is to create something even more in tune with what visitors love about Cromer Pier, he said. "This pause gives us a chance to put the right foundations in place so the business remains sustainable and resilient for the long term." No exact reopening date has been penciled in, but with Easter now less than a month away, it has been confirmed that this target has been pushed back. We don't currently have an opening date, but the plan is now to reopen in time for the summer, a spokesman commented. He added, the ice cream kiosk at the front of the pier will be reopening at Easter in an exciting collaboration with a nationally recognised brand.
A B&B has voiced its frustration after the soap in its toilets was stolen for the fourth time in as many months. The Dial House in Reefham said it has been targeted time and again by slippery-handed thieves. Tom Ellis, one of the owners, said it is becoming a concerning pattern. We could just try and put cheaper soap in there instead, but we try to make coming to the Dial House a proper experience, he explained. It's such a shame. We want the Dial House to be a real centre where people can come and meet others and have a nice time, but this sort of thing goes totally against it. Mr. Ellis said the bottles cost around £20 each and they had all been unscrewed from the wall. It's tricky at the moment because, of course, it's hard for anyone in hospitality to make any money, he added. I could just put some cheap stuff in there, but we try to create a real nice experience all the way around here.
A pub in a small Norfolk village is set to reopen under a new landlord. The Horse and Groom in Tunstead, a village on the edge of the Norfolk Broads, is set to open its doors once again as a bid for a new licence has emerged. Robert Cameron has submitted an application to North Norfolk District Council with hopes to serve alcohol and play live music at the venue. Mr. Cameron has applied to sell alcohol on and off the premises between midday to midnight, between Tuesday and Friday, and between 10 a.m. to midnight between Saturday and Monday. This has been amended until 1 a.m. on New Year's Eve. He also planned to play recorded music and indoor sporting events from midday to 11 p.m. daily and live music from 5 to 11 p.m. between Tuesday to Friday and from midday to 11 p.m. Saturday to Monday. In the application it said there would be strict ID checks, promotion of responsible drinking and communication with locals. Mr. Cameron, who is also the landlord of the Shoulder of Mutton in Strumpshaw, added that there would be CCTV and would promote a good working practice and expect good conduct from patrons.
A historic yacht charter company is marking National Tea Day by offering one lucky person a special sailing experience. The Wherry Yacht Charter is celebrating the day, marked on April the 21st, by offering a free place on tea-themed sailings. Great Yarmouth played an important role in the regional transport of tea. Trading wherries, shallow drafted sailing vessels specific to Norfolk and Suffolk, carried tea alongside dominant cargoes like coal, grain and timber. The unloading and transport of these leaves to market towns and estates allowed tea drinking to gain popularity, particularly throughout the 18th and 19th centuries. Many wherries were then remodelled into pleasure wherries, while wherry yachts were specifically made for leisure cruising, contributing to the rise of tourism on the Norfolk Broads. The Wherry Yacht Charter Charitable Trust has five craft on its book: Hather, Ardia, Olive, White Moth and Norada. For the chance to win two places for either a cake and sail or a tea at twilight cruise in the coming season, participants have until April the 30th to email jk@wherryyachtcharter.org with the subject National Tea Day Competition and list the five wherries managed by Wherry Yacht Charter.
A North Norfolk B&B has taken top spot on a hit TV show competition. Holly Lodge Thursford, near Fakenham, has won Best B&B in the latest series of Channel 4's Four in a Bed. Barbara Cushing and Elizabeth Good were front and centre as hosts of Holly Lodge, embarking on a week of camaraderie, critique, glass blowing and vintage steam engines. Each episode brought highs and lows, leading to the overall question, would they stay again? Holly Lodge's episode was aired on Wednesday, and the other competitors all gave huge praises and high scores. All of their guests answered the important question and agreed they would stay again. Barbara said, "What an amazing achievement to be crowned winners of the ever-popular Four in a Bed. We do feel we are truly unique, and we are so grateful the other competitors felt the same. This award goes out to the whole team who continue to make Holly Lodge a five-star destination." Elizabeth, who hosted alongside Barbara, said, "What an unforgettable experience Four in a Bed was. It has been a great privilege to show our little corner of Norfolk and invite new customers into the world of Holly Lodge and Thursford. It was amazing from start to finish. Holly Lodge has 6 bedrooms, a shepherd's hut, and is located within 5 minutes of the famous Thursford Collection, home to the popular Christmas Spectacular." Barbara concludes, "To win Four in a Bed is a real jewel in the crown for our little secret hideaway in Thursford. Elizabeth has been a great colleague in this experience, and I couldn't have done this without her. We are looking forward to welcoming everyone to the Four in a Bed winner, Holly Lodge Thursford, soon."
A sharp-minded and determined woman has shared her secrets to a long and fruitful life as she marked her 100th birthday. Louisa Flynn celebrated the special milestone on Wednesday, surrounded by her family and staff at Lloyd Court in High Kelling, as she recalled her fond memories spanning an entire century. Described as a remarkable lady who is an inspiration to all who know her, Louisa has touched the hearts of many over the years. And when she was asked what her secret to reaching 100 was, her answer was straightforward. She said, "Keep moving, keep thinking, and grasp every opportunity that comes your way with both hands." Born on March the 4th in 1926, Louisa grew up in Mallow, County Cork, where she recalled a childhood filled with laughter, hard work and mischievous adventure, including sneaking gooseberries from a nearby orchard. In 1946, shortly after the end of Second World War, she made the brave decision to move to England with her sister Margaret to begin a new chapter in her life. She lived and worked in Colchester and Newton Aycliffe, where her daughter Marie was born, after settling in Sheringham in 1967. Throughout her working life, Louisa dedicated herself to caring and nursing roles, often working 12-hour shifts 7 days a week. She has said that her most rewarding role was working on a mental health ward in Colchester, work she found deeply meaningful and fulfilling. In 2004, Louisa then made her home at Lloyd Court, a housing with care scheme, where she has maintained her independence since. Family remains at the heart of her world. She is a proud mother, grandmother to 2 grandsons, and great-grandmother to 8 great-grandchildren. Staff have described her as sharp-minded and determined, with an impressive memory and a daily routine that includes walking and stopping for her daily exercises. A statement from the home added, "Her century of life stands as a testament to determination, hard work, love and an unwavering spirit, an inspiration to all who know her."
Changes to plans to convert a former bank in a Norfolk town into housing have led to a town council objecting over downsizing the number of proposed flats. Developers Gaskin Builders had lodged plans with Broadland Council to transform the old Barclays branch in Aylsham's marketplace into 11 flats in August last year. But now the scheme has been revised to offer only 9 flats, which has sparked an objection from Aylsham Town Council. In the council's response to the bid, it notes that the reduction from 11 to 9 would reduce the 106 obligations of the applicant. There are legal agreements between local authorities and developments which cover a wide range of contributions, including affordable housing and highways and town centre improvements. Dropping from 11 to 9 flats moved the scheme below the major 10-plus homes threshold, so the council would usually no longer seat on-site affordable housing or most Section 106 payments. It also notes that part of the plans are factually incorrect regarding the marking of a nearby building, despite previously raising it as a concern. The developers have not explained why the amendment has been made in the planning documents, but it does follow an objection from Anglia Water. The water firm objected to any connection to its foul network from the proposed development due to capacity constraints and pollution risk, and said there are no details of how surface water will be discharged. Anglian Water has yet to make a comment on the revised plans. The revised proposals have also included more commercial units on the ground floor. It was originally planned to only include one, but now it includes three, each with their own kitchens. Barclays closed the branch on January the 11th, 2022, and the building has remained empty ever since. Developers said the building is in urgent need of repurposing to prevent further decline, and stated efforts to find another tenant for the three-storey property were unsuccessful, making its current use not viable.
A landlord has apologised to councillors after creating a games room at his pub without planning permission. Paul Rees, landlord of the Feathers pub in Aylsham, could have faced enforcement action for turning an outbuilding into the games room and adding a single-storey link to the rest of the pub without consent. But members of Broadland District Council's planning committee agreed to grant retrospective permission for the work done at the Grade 2 listed site. The building, at the back of the Causton Road pub, includes a pool table and a television, the committee heard at a meeting on Thursday. Mr. Rees said, "My apologies for building it. We had two existing rooms out there and I just put walls around them to create the space. When I took over the Feathers in July 2023, it was on its knees and near closure. So you would have had another closed pub not generating anything for anybody. We do care about our community, but we are also a business, and pub businesses are dying out at the rate of thousands a year. Concerns have been raised about noise and smoking in the pub's beer garden, although the application also received 10 letters of support. Officers at Broadland Council said its own investigation considered noise was not at a significant level to warrant action, while a noise management plan has been produced by the pub. They said, although some noise and general disturbances occurs from customers gathering in the garden to smoke, particularly near neighbouring boundaries, this activity is not a direct consequence of converting the former smoking shelter into a games room. Customers were never limited to using the former shelter and have always been permitted to smoke anywhere within the garden area. Noise levels are expected to remain in line with what would reasonably be anticipated from an established public house. Mr. Rees said he had installed acoustic tiles and curtains throughout the pub, including in the games room. Eleanor Lamming, Green Councillor and Vice Chairman of the Planning Committee, said the link building was maybe of a lower quality of design than might have been hoped for. But, she said, I think the ongoing continuance of a business to serve the local community is a real major factor in making me support this.
You are listening to edition number 2008 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday the 13th of March 2026. We have articles about a seafood vendor, young volunteers and a village country club. The Mardler magazine supplement, two obituaries and details of some What's On events. But first, we have four letters to the editor of the North Norfolk News with the topics false savings on waste and the Sheringham bus shelter. Could the epidemic of waste dumping have anything to do with councils making it harder, having to book instead of turning up, and more expensive for folk to dispose of waste? Surely the cost-benefit balance has now dipped to the cost side, i.e. more expensive to have the dumped waste removed than any income from waste legitimately disposed of. Mike Josefiak.
Every week it seems that another minority splinter group is formed to try to impose its will on Sheringham Town Council with regard to its accepted plan for the bus stop. Their decision was quite simple. They were faced with three choices. One, demolish it. Two, move it. Three, modify it. One and two were unacceptable, which left three. This is the course of action that the councillors have chosen to take. The vast majority of the people of Sheringham have accepted the plan and want this blight on the landscape over and done with. Let them get on with it without further distraction and expense to the town precept. Brian Farrow, Sheringham.
Whenever I read about the Sheringham bus shelter saga, I'm reminded of the phrase, N for N, normal for Norfolk. This was a phrase allegedly devised by a medical professional at a Norfolk hospital to categorise some of their more intellectually challenged patients. The council want to build a smart new travel hub, which required the demolition of a utilitarian 1950s half-finished brick bus shelter. Outsiders would think marvellous, but not in Norfolk. We have a demonstration to save this old bus shelter, thus putting the whole scheme in jeopardy. You couldn't make it up. Paul Milner, Sheringham.
Mike Holmes of Sheringham writes, I, a Sheringham resident for 21 years, have been able to ascertain without a shadow of a doubt that the vast majority of the local Sheringham folk I discussed this total farce of the damn bus shelter with could not care one jot about its potential demise. Previous widespread reports that a 75% majority of Sheringham residents feel very strongly that this 1952 pretty damned ordinary structure be retained in all its glory is plain wrong. This perverse percentage, a figure supported in its entirety by our local MP, could not be much more of a travesty of the truth. A mere 700 folk initially last December seemed to make their observations about that shelter's demise, of which 525 demanded that the shelter remain in its full glory of ordinariness, with the solitary saving grace of Colin Seal's excellent train mural. That ratio is the 75% that deluded Steph Aquarone brought up in the House of Commons. Yes, he really did. The question now is just how many of the other 7,897 inhabitants of this town could care one little bit about keeping the bus shelter. For goodness sake, can we now just move on and rid ourselves of any more column inches of stupidity and come into the 21st century? Sadly, and extremely infuriatingly to myself and many others, it now seems we're going to be saddled with this awful building site blemish until the autumn, and that is totally unacceptable. This town's council should feel utterly ashamed of their crass, confused involvement in this whole sorry farrago, because the true blame lies firmly and squarely at their front doors.
Margaret Joan Hardingham passed away on February the 24th, 2026, aged 80. Beloved wife of Albert, deceased. A dearly loved mum, grandmother, great and great-great-grandmother and sister. The funeral service will take place at Cromer Crematorium on Tuesday, March the 24th at 10 a.m. Family flowers only, please. All inquiries to Fox's Funeral Services. Telephone number 01263 512-427. Bernard George Smith died unexpectedly on February 24, 2026, aged 89. Beloved husband of Barbara, deceased. A dearly loved dad of Nicola and Alan. The funeral service will take place at Cromer Crematorium on Tuesday, March the 24th at midday. Family flowers only, please. Donations may be left at the service to be equally divided between each and Alzheimer's Research UK. All inquiries to Fox's Funeral Services. Telephone number 01263 512 427.
Forthcoming events include Sunday 15th of March, Mother's Day at Hoverton Hall, 10:30 a.m. to 3 p.m, Mums Go Free. Saturday 21st of March, 7 p.m. at Fakenham Parish Church, join Fakenham Choral Society as they sing Vierne's Messe Solennelle and Matthew Coleridge's Requiem, combining a new work with something older and more traditional.
We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement. We include Memories of School Days, Sundays Are Not Boring, and Norfolk's Waterborne Home Guard. But first, what a tangled web we weave in our thoughts about spiders. Spiders have actively fueled fear and suspicion in popular culture for centuries, becoming an integral part of the Halloween canon. With their multiple beady eyes, bristly legs, fangs, and a reputation that far exceeds the reality of their character, they are understandably not everyone's favourite creature. However, some of us find them a wonder, often colourful, always acrobatic, and their ability to spin patterned silk webs is fascinating. Most of us, even with a limited knowledge of the natural world, know that spiders are not insects, but arachnids. They have, of course, only a head and abdomen, 8 legs rather than 6, and no wings. Flying spiders, now that's an arachnophobe's Halloween nightmare. Our encounters with spiders are rarely a Hammer horror experience of clawing an exaggerated web from our face in a dark crypt or dank dungeon. More commonly, it's in the comfort of our own homes. The gangly-legged cellar spiders that leave those infuriating cobwebs in hard-to-reach corners. The large brown house spider with its boxing glove-like pedipalps trying to clamber out of the bath, or a tiny black money spider hanging by a single thread, its safe landing assured in the vain hope of financial reward. Unlike most invertebrates, spiders remain common in autumn and fairly numerous in winter too, forming an important food source for small birds, particularly wrens. During an early morning autumn stroll, frosty meadows reveal a ghostly sea of gossamer spun by a multitude of tiny rappelling spiders. The threads create the appearance of a shimmering silver net draped across the field, a touch of beauty on a cold day. My favourites to look out for this time of year are the orb spiders. Their webs are a familiar form, but the splendour of their engineering skill is barely perceptible in summer. Yet in winter, on a cool damp day, hundreds are visible. It is then that they exhibit their artistry, particularly when spangled by necklaces of tiny icy droplets. The commonest is the garden orb, which has a white cross on its back. Like most of the orb spiders, this is plump and uniquely marked. You can easily identify the 4-spot, marbled and green orb spiders, which are also found in gardens during the autumn months. Even up to late October, if you are very lucky, you may come across the magnificent wasp spider hanging patiently for its trap to be sprung by its grasshopper prey. The female is large and distinctively marked with yellow, black and white stripes, mimicking its namesake to warn off predators. It spins a low-slung web in rough grass and has a unique zigzag pattern running down the centre of it. The male is much smaller and, as a suitor, must cautiously approach his potential mate. If he isn't careful, during an amorous encounter, he may end up on her menu. His best tactic is to move in when she molts and her jaws are soft. Maybe on reflection, spiders do have a justified place in the terrors of Halloween. Many animal names are based on what they do, and spider is from the old English word spinan, a person that spins thread. Other names for spiders, particularly around European cultures, refer to them as being venomous or even poisonous if eaten. From Greek mythology to Saxon lore and J.R.R. Tolkien to Harry Potter, cultural references have spiders front and centre as the baddie, Spider-Man being the exception perhaps. However, they rarely bite as their fangs are neither strong enough nor long enough to pierce human skin. Unfairly, the nastiest bites always seem to be allocated to spiders. Although one warning, I have been bitten by a woodlouse hunting spider and that did hurt, resulting in an irritating itching feeling for days after. This spider needs to penetrate the woodlouse's armour plating, so is one of the few UK spiders that can deliver a meaningful bite. Despite the encounter, I remain convinced that spiders are our allies. The large house spider that may greet us in the morning from the bathroom sink is worth rescuing, for it feeds on fleas, silverfish, clothes moth larvae, and all kinds of other household pests. Spiders are now employed as pest controllers in commercial greenhouses, and any gardener will tell you the benefits spiders bring to flower beds and allotment plots. Spider venom has even been adapted for use in several modern medicines. Franklin D. Roosevelt, in his inaugural presidential speech, stated that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Apparently a Republican at the time, with some wit added, and spiders. That article by Robert Morgan appeared in the EDP on the 29th of October, 2024.
Were my school days the best of my life? You must be kidding. Whoever coined the phrase that our school years were the best days of our lives should be given a detention and lines. Some may have been lucky enough to sail through their school days in a happy haze of self-discovery, sporting achievements, brilliant exam successes, prize-giving awards and scholarships to further academic brilliance at university. But for others, me included, it was more of a lesson in survival and struggle, largely bumping along the rocky seabed of the bottom of the class. A recent trawl of school reports during an appeal by the City of Norwich School Old Boys Union for archive material to send to the Norfolk Record Office has brought it all back. Terse, damning, though probably quite accurate, assessments by the gowned grammar school masters of the 1970s CNS summed up the academic acumen, or lack of it, of this Heartsease council house boy as appears to have difficulty remembering and understanding facts. Fourth year chemistry, weak, no signs of work. Fourth year biology, results not good enough. First year maths, his exam work was incredibly poor. Religious education, still quiet, but his written work is good. First year English, it is a pity he cannot be more forthcoming in class discussion. Sound without being brilliant. Sixth form geography, and in summary, he continues to produce satisfactory results, which result largely from hard work rather than great flair. The teachers did acknowledge my lowly class positions were partly due to being in the mix with a top stream of uni-bound, clever and confident young chaps, many of whom lived in the well-heeled leafy avenues near the playing fields of Eton, in contrast to my humble Heartsease roots. However, despite the teacher's reservations, at the end of the CNS sausage machine, I managed to emerge with 2 A-levels and 11 O-levels. The only total failures were history and Latin, which I put down to the first point in the list above, which I cannot remember. Indeed, my faith in the school exam system was totally shattered from the moment I opened the results envelope in front of my expectant parents and found my only top grade was in maths. That simply did not add up, as it was consistently my worst subject. Yes, there were some happy school memories. Lunchtime football on a gut full of gristly mints and stodgy chocolate pudding. Geography trips to Swanage, Salisbury and Scalt Head, which despite being less exotic than some of today's educational outings, were an adventure for a boy from a family with no car and singing in the mass school choir in St Andrew's Hall. And I had my first ever bit of writing published in the school magazine, a poem about a bat when I was in the first form in 1967. The editor's remark about son of a famous father references a teacher whose nickname was Batman. Cannot remember if he did dinner duties, so maybe those school days weren't all that bad after all. And they probably shaped my future by showing me life roads not to go down, science, maths or religion, and steered me towards being a man of words, written rather than spoken. Whether my rather embarrassing reports prove useful in the county's social history archive remains open to debate, except that I would obviously be too timid to fight my case in such a class discussion. That article by Richard Batson was taken from the EDP of 5th of October 2024.
And now, why Sundays should still be seen as special and not boring. Ah dear, oh dear, ah dear me, stone me, what a life, what's the time? A memorable line from Hancock's Half Hour, which painted a vivid radio picture of Sunday afternoon in the Hancock household sometime in the 1950s. I've never forgotten that episode of Hancock. I've never forgotten Sundays in the 50s either. During those Sundays, everything seemed to be closed, and after church and Sunday lunch, Mum and Dad would sit by the coal fire and snooze over the Sunday papers. Boring. Though I was never a fan of Sunday lunch, I have to say that Mum's cooking was a cut above that of Tony Hancock's household, where the lad takes a snipe at Griselda Pugh's culinary efforts. I thought my mother was bad cook, but at least her gravy used to move about. Yours just lies there and sets. Sunday for me, then, was a day I dreaded, just like the one in the Hancock episode. To a young kid it seemed endless and dead boring, with only the prospect of school the next day, and usually first thing, a session of arithmetic, not called maths in those days. So when I heard news of the opening of Tesco's in Stornoway for the first time in 16 years, I had mixed feelings. I remembered when the law changed in 1994 and some shops began to open on Sundays with reduced times of trading. That's when I had a job in television, so was used to Sunday working, although technically, as a Catholic, I should have declined because, as the third commandment puts it, 6 days you may labour, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord. A famous example of declining to toil on religious grounds was that of the runner Eric Liddell, who refused to take part in the 1924 Olympic Games in Paris because the race was scheduled for the Sunday. He was not alone. I was surprised to learn that if you had a contract which stated that you didn't wish to work on a Sunday, then by law you can't be forced to. I wonder how many still feel strongly about this. There is an argument that nobody is forcing anyone to go shopping or do anything on a Sunday if they don't want to. I must say that there was a time when I stayed away from the shops on Sundays because, like some of the Stornoway people who were against the Tesco opening on Sunday, I hoped that Sunday might be kept as a special day. There was a time when Sunday used to be a good time to drive around, but now it's like any other day, with parking problems, traffic queues and packed shops. I know this because I've occasionally joined that Sunday brigade. I even got annoyed the other day when I found a particular store didn't open until 10:30. So much for my principles. Oddly enough, since I stopped regular work, Sunday has become a day that I look forward to. That's not because it should be a day of rest, it's because I don't feel guilty not working on it. Although it's a day like any other, in many ways, it still feels different. When I was in full-time work, I wanted to make every second of a Sunday count because it wasn't a Monday. I had a good job, but Monday meant another week of work ahead. I was lucky to have a job and I was grateful, but it did feel like drudgery now and then. Now I'm fond of Sundays because I don't have to fret about that dreaded arithmetic class again. I don't have to cook and eat Sunday dinner anymore, gravy or no gravy. That article by Helen McDermott appeared in the EDP on the 25th of November 2024.
And to finish this week's supplement, Dad's Army Afloat. The Home Guard on the Norfolk Broads during the Second World War played a vital role in defending a region considered especially vulnerable to invasion. The Norfolk coast, with its wide, open and gently sloping beaches, alongside the Broads' extensive network of rivers, lakes and marshes, was seen as a potential landing site for enemy forces, particularly via airborne or seaborne assault. The Home Guard was formed in 1940, originally called the Local Defence Volunteers, and famously portrayed by the beloved TV series Dad's Army, filmed in Norfolk. It was mainly composed of men who were too old, too young, or otherwise ineligible for regularly military service. They were tasked with defending Britain in the event of invasion, particularly in rural and strategically important areas. In the early years of the Second World War, the threat of German invasion was very real. Britain's eastern coastline was widely regarded as the most likely point of attack, with East Anglia in particular considered highly vulnerable. A vast network of coastal and inland defences were created to destroy, or at least slow, any invasion attempt. The sheer scale of the defences was staggering, especially considering that similar fortifications were replicated around the entire British Isles. The Norfolk and Suffolk Broads formed a crucial part of these defensive plans. In Ludham, for example, the army began constructing a camp in 1939. The first bombs fell on the village in 1940. RAF Ludham Airfield was built during 1941 as a satellite to RAF Coltishall and was initially home to Spitfires. The Ludham Home Guard numbered around 80 volunteers. At the outbreak of war in September 1939, a rapid programme began to build pillboxes, anti-tank blocks, traps, roadblocks, gun emplacements, barbed wire barriers and slit trenches along the coastline and further inland. If enemy forces managed to penetrate coastal defences, towns and villages were the next line of defence. Major roads, rail lines and rivers were obvious routes of attack. By mid-1940, the UK was prepared for invasion. Over the following year, defences were strengthened further as new strategies and weaponry developed. Towns, villages and strategic points were categorised based on the importance of their transport and communication links. The Broads are flat, waterlogged and often inaccessible by road. This made conventional military defence strategies impractical, especially during the early years of the war, when invasion was a real concern. To respond, Home Guard units and associated auxiliary forces turned to the water for mobility, stealth and advantage. The Broads presented several military challenges. The flat, open terrain was ideal for glider landings. navigable waterways could be used by enemy craft to penetrate inland. A sparse population made monitoring movements difficult. As a result, this region received special defensive attention. A specialist unit, the Broads Flotilla, was set up with its base at Wroxham. The Home Guard monitored key waterways and bridges, particularly where boats could land or vehicles could cross. They patrolled rivers such as the Bure, Yar, Ant and Waveney, using boats of every kind, from wherries to canoes, including motor launches from private owners or hire fleets. Patrols operated primarily at night, moving silently through reed beds, watching for signs of enemy infiltration or sabotage. Canoes and flat-bottom punts allowed access to very shallow or hidden channels inaccessible by foot. Boats were often camouflaged with reeds, paint or netting to blend into the natural surroundings. Some were equipped with concealed weapons, such as Lewis guns or rifles. Larger boats or commandeered pleasure cruisers were sometimes repurposed as floating observation posts or mobile headquarters. Some were equipped with radio gear, map tables, and field supplies. The extremely limited number of bridges over the rivers in Broadland at Acle, Ludham, Potterheim and Wroxham made them of strategic importance. Units received training in laying underwater charges, blocking waterways and preparing to demolish bridges or locks to slow an invading force. Explosive charges were also planned for key drainage mills, river crossings and sluices to flood or deny access to strategic areas. Boats were hidden or immobilised to prevent enemy use, and some waterway sections were blocked with sunken boats or chains. The flat landscape was also used for decoy airfields and lighting schemes designed to mislead German bombers. Some Home Guard members were trained in guerrilla tactics and sabotage, especially in the event of a successful invasion. The Swamp Commandos was an informal nickname for Home Guard units stationed around the Norfolk Broads during the Second World War. In this unique geography, conventional military tactics had limited use. Local Home Guard units adapted accordingly, creating a swamp-based, guerrilla-style defence force. The Swamp Commandos trained in sabotage, ambush and irregular warfare similar to commandos. Their focus was on hit-and-run tactics to disrupt enemy logistics. If German forces landed on the East Anglian coast and tried to push inland through the Broads, they trained with explosives and used booby traps to sabotage bridges or canal locks, vital choke points to slow an advancing enemy. Many members were locals, fishermen, reed cutters, and others intimately familiar with the difficult terrain. Their ability to move silently through the complex rivers, dikes, and marshy land gave them a tactical advantage. One of the best-kept secrets of the Second World War was the existence of the British Resistance Units, Auxiliary Units, AUs, as they were later named. Some members of the Home Guard may have been in contact with or inspired by this secret resistance organisation formed to operate behind enemy lines in the event of invasion. Though the AUs operated under strict secrecy, there is evidence of coordination. Some boats were possibly designated for evasion, escape, or hit-and-run raids from hidden hideouts. These highly trained secret units would go to ground if Germany invaded and operated from concealed underground operational bases, OBs. Locally, OBs are known to have been in Ludham, Nettishead, Wroxham, Hoveton and Maltby. The AU mission included sabotage, assassination of collaborators and ambushing supply lines. They operated undercover. Even local Home Guard leadership often did not know of their existence. Some local accounts suggest Home Guard patrols were aware of certain hideouts or had off-the-record orders to avoid specific areas, almost certainly where AU hideouts existed. Many waterborne units operated semi-independently, often led by locals with deep knowledge of the Broads. Naval or Army liaison officers sometimes advised on tactics and supplied limited equipment. Defence of the Broads was part of a broader plan to create a stop line, a last-ditch inland defensive barrier should coastal defences be breached. Home Guard water units were essential to defending or sabotaging crossings and navigation routes enemy forces might use. Although the Home Guard never saw combat in Norfolk, their presence was a key part of Britain's layered defence strategy. Today, some of their activities are documented in local museums and historical societies, including the Museum of the Broads in Stalham. The Ludham Archives is also a great source of information about the village and its wartime activities. And that item by Whimsical of Womack is taken from the February 2026 issue of the Norfolk Magazine. Our thanks go to the editors and contributors of the EDP and the Norfolk Magazine for permission to use their material.
We now finish with our last selection of news and views, starting with seafood vendor's new location at Manor House. A hit seafood vendor has revealed it has a new permanent location at a historic North Norfolk estate. Randy's Seafood can be found throughout the summer season at Wifton Hall near Clyne next to sea, following a successful few pop-ups. This is the first time we have had a fixed location to call home, George Randall, owner, said. After four successful years, we have invested in a new trailer that is much bigger than the one we used before. Wifton Hall owner Desmond McCarthy approached us about a residency last year, but our diary was already booked up. We popped up several times throughout the summer, however, and it proved very popular, so we are really excited to spend the season there. Randy's Seafood will open for business for the Easter weekend, serving fresh lobsters, crabs and seafood platters from April the 3rd to the 6th, with further dates to be released soon. We will be serving up your seafood favourites, as well as a few new additions we think customers are going to love, Mr. Randall said. We are hoping to run some themed evenings and have a big barbecue lined up for some surf and turf. Randy's started life in 2022 when Clyde Local launched the business in a converted horse box with his fisherman brother Henry supplying the seafood. He previously worked at the Wifton Bell and then Rocky Bottoms in West Runton before he decided to branch out on his own. Reflecting on the last 4 years of business, Mr. Randall added, "We have watched it go from strength to strength. We are keeping hold of the smaller trailer and will still be running the same route that we have always done. Mysa Bar will also be running a new foodie destination at Wifton Hall this summer."
Four young volunteers have been honoured for their dedication to first aid and community service. They have been named County Cadets and Badgers of the Year for their work in Norfolk and Waveney. 17-year-old Ruby Prescott from Thorpe St Andrew has been named County Cadet of the Year and now progresses to the National Selection Event in Staffordshire, where she could be named Regional or National Cadet of the Year. Miss Prescott said, "Being selected for County Cadet of the Year was something I honestly didn't expect, but I am very proud to have been chosen and honoured to be able to get to support my county in a meaningful way. I am so grateful for the opportunity to help other people in St John build their confidence, make new friendships and have a positive impact to their experience as a cadet, just as so many people in the organisation have done for me. Ruby is joined by Lexi Rain Vincent, 16, from Aylsham, who has been named Deputy County Cadet of the Year. For the first time in Norfolk, St John Ambulance has awarded County Badger of the Year titles. Sienna Wig, 10, from the Great Yarmouth Badger Set, has been named County Badger of the Year, while Ethan Parrott, 9, from DIS Badger Set, is Deputy County Badger of the Year. Callum Hardy, County Youth Lead for Norfolk and Waveney, said, "These awards highlight the incredible commitment shown by our young volunteers. From the youngest badgers to our senior cadets, they are learning vital life-saving skills while making a real difference in their communities. And we are immensely proud of all of them. Everyone involved with St John Ambulance in Norfolk wishes Ruby the very best of luck as she represents the county at the national selection event."
A village country club has welcomed visitors to its stylish new hall following a major revamp. Melton Constable Country Club has unveiled its new look facility at a relaunch event. The club, based at the Railway Institute building, hopes the transformation will open itself up more to the community. Matt Crowley, bar manager for the club, said the works were much needed and was excited by the progress. He added, "The walls were crumbling, the decor was quite old. It was quite a cold and dated space to look at. Now it looks really stunning. The works we've done have been really well received and all the feedback from members has been positive. We didn't advertise too much because we wanted to keep people in suspense. We wanted somewhere for people to think, wow, what a facility. Among the works are a renovated stage, modern LED lighting, a new audio system and acoustic soundboards. The next phase of the works will see the games room being revamped with a pool table, bar billiards and a football table all planned. It's just nice to offer more to customers," said Mr. Crowley. "We've already seen more people coming into the club. The snooker room upstairs was shut off, but it's been cleared out now and become a hireable space, which has really taken off. There's still a lot more work to do, but you've got to start somewhere, and we're really pleased with what we've done so far. The club now hopes to become a talking point and more attractive space to hire for weddings, parties and other celebrations." Mr. Crowley said, "We can hold plays, we can do live music. We couldn't really do those things before the works. We've also now opened 7 days a week and we've signed up some new members. It's lots of little changes, but they've made a big impact."
A dance-a-thon is the perfect excuse to dress up, get moving and support a good cause. And in that spirit, a charity event with a movie-themed fancy dress twist will take place in Cromer on Sunday, March the 29th at Cromer Sports Centre from 1pm to 4pm. It will raise funds for breast cancer now. Participants can enjoy a variety of routines from Zumba and clubbersize to burlesque. Karen Swalsh from Munsley and one of the organisers said, "We started these events in 2024 in memory of my godmother and raised £1,500 for Marie Curie Cancer Care, which she supported. Last year's Danthathon raised £1,300 for Dementia Care UK, a charity chosen by co-organiser Gemma Parker. Ms. Swash, a team leader at North Norfolk District Council, said, "People can drop in and do what they can. It's brilliant fun and nothing too serious, just having a good time and raising some money. The event will include a prize for best fancy dress, a raffle and refreshments provided by Swash Nosh Catering. Tickets are £12 on the door or £10 in advance by calling Karen on 07388 340 288 or via fitness.com. with Gemma on 07392 757 458.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, our listener liaison officer is Imogen Waterson on 01263 587 610. If you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker to listen using the talking newspaper skill. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk. But please, when returning the pouch and memory stick, remember to reverse the label. The sound engineer this week was Richard Preston, and the editor-producer was David Audley. And our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in thanking you for listening and wishing you a week to remember. And we look forward to joining you again next Friday. But for now, though, from today's readers, it's
cheerio! Cheerio.